Today is Tuesday, January 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, China's new coronavirus has claimed more lives in China as global efforts continue to contain the outbreak.
It's really critical that hospitals make sure that the infection prevention and control measures that they have in place are adequate.
Plus, President Trump's defense team took to the podium on their second day of presentations. We have the latest. And this week, Britain exits the European Union. How are people preparing for it? Those stories and more are next. China's new coronavirus has claimed more lives in China as the global effort to continue to contain the outbreak. Schools in China and Hong Kong have been delayed to try and contain the virus, while China's exclusion zone of cities on lockdown continue to widen. Reuters' Jason Albino starts us off.
The death toll from China's new coronavirus continued to rise Monday as global efforts to contain the rapid outbreak doubled down. The number of confirmed cases in China is in the thousands. U.S. officials reported multiple cases on Sunday, and it's already spread to other countries, including Thailand, Australia, and France. More than 10 cities in Hubei have already been shut down. Hubei is the province in which Wuhan, the city where the outbreak began, is located. And neighboring provinces are anticipating the exclusion list will only widen. China said it would extend a week-long Lunar New Year holiday in a bid to slow the spread of the virus. State media reported that Beijing will also delay the reopening of schools and universities after the holiday. Hong Kong announced a similar plan, with schools to remain closed until February 17th. Hong Kong also said it would ban entry to travelers who have visited Hubei in the last 14 days. The government's plan for a quarantine zone was stalled, though, after protesters torched a newly built residential building that authorities planned to use as a quarantine facility.
Our message is very simple. Don't make this estate into a quarantine area, as there are lots of residents here. It's that simple.
Airports around the world are ramping up screening measures of Chinese passengers, though its effectiveness has been questioned by health officials. Some foreign governments are working to evacuate their citizens from Wuhan. France said its evacuees will spend 14 days in quarantine to stop the possible spread of the virus. Also on Sunday, Chinese officials confirmed that the ability of the new virus to spread is getting stronger and that infections could continue to rise. No deaths have been reported outside of China from the virus so far.
That was Reuters reporter Jason Albino. Chinese Premier Li Keqiang visited the city of Wuhan on Monday to meet with health officials and examine the response to the outbreak. Global stock markets plunged on Monday as investors feared the economic impact from the coronavirus. The latest figures reported by Chinese media include almost 4,200 cases and over 100 deaths. In all, cases have been reported in Australia, Canada, France, Hong Kong, Japan, Macau, Malaysia, Nepal, Portugal, Singapore, South Korea, Taiwan, Thailand, and the United States, as well as Vietnam. Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department has updated travel advisory to China to level 3, advising citizens to reconsider to travel China due to the novel coronavirus. Now, to dive deeper into the topic, I spoke earlier to Dr. Jose Vasquez, Division Chief and Professor of Medicine and Infectious Diseases at Augusta University. I began our conversation by asking him, with the large number of cases each year of influenza and pneumonia that affect each person around the globe, why is there so much concern about the coronavirus?
I think the important difference is the fact that it's a new, or what's called a novel virus, right? From the prior respiratory viruses that we've had, nobody has heard about it. And because nobody's heard about it, and it's coming from another country, especially in the United States, I think we are, you know, a little uptight, I guess you can say, or anxious about this disease. The other thing that makes it a little scary to the population is the fact that we don't know anything about it. We don't know how it spreads. We don't know how contagious it is. In other words, is it a couple of days where you maybe have no symptoms? And then all of a sudden you have fever and a cough, and then you're infectious, or have you been infectious since you've been So it's really the unknown, I think, that's the big fear.
I saw some reports that the WHO is really putting the impetus on healthcare workers, healthcare facilities, to really make sure that their screening procedures are really tight and stringent when either dealing with people coming from Wuhan or who may have been exposed. What kinds of things do people need to keep in mind?
So that's a good question. So in the healthcare facilities, we have been prepared for what we call emerging infections or emerging diseases way back since the SARS. The initial SARS was back in 2002, 2003, right? So what we do is, our first question that we have when somebody comes in with a fever and a cough is, have you traveled anywhere? Has that person traveled anywhere within the past 2 to 4 weeks? If they have, then those people will immediately be put into, put a mask on, and then they'll go into isolation. And so we get it right away in the emergency room, or the walk-in clinic, or the walk-in doctor's office. So we really jump on it quickly to prevent that spread.
Is a mask good enough?
That's a good, everybody asked me that today. So I've had like four
because that's a big question, right?
Whether
it's SARS or the coronavirus that we're talking about now or other things, the first instinct is, oh, I'm going to put on a mask. But there's certain masks that are better at filtering out particulate matter than others.
There is one school of thought that it does help. There's another school of thought that it doesn't really help. I think I tend to be somewhere in between. So what happens with most masks is after you've been wearing it for an hour or two, because of the humidity in your breath, the mask gets wet, right? Mm-hmm. As soon as the mask gets wet, it doesn't work.
All right, one last question. You're a physician. Okay. You're a doctor. You're the head of the infectious disease program at Augusta University.
Yeah.
What is something that you're looking at in terms of the reporting and the information coming out from healthcare professionals who have firsthand experience with this that we as lay people, people who are just reading the news, may not be keenly aware of?
Well, I think the important part to this is how is it become contagious, right? That's the key, because that can go from a few people up to a couple of million. So what we do know is, and what should it be recommended, is anybody who feels sick, who has symptoms of a respiratory tract infection, should be staying home, right? Especially if they've come from Asia.
That was Dr. Jose Vasquez at Augusta University speaking to me from Georgia. An American military aircraft crashed in eastern Afghanistan Monday, but there was no indication so far that it had been brought down by enemy fire, according to the U.S. military. Spokesman for the U.S. forces in Afghanistan said the Bombardier E-11A crashed in the Ghazni province, and an investigation of its causes was ongoing. Monday's plane crash is not expected to derail U.S. Taliban peace talks if it turns out to have been an accident. Officials and tribal leaders say that an escalation in fighting between the Saudi-led military coalition and Houthi rebels in Yemen has killed and wounded hundreds of people over the past week. The U.S.-backed Arab coalition, battling to restore Yemen's internationally recognized government, stepped up airstrikes on rebel targets northeast of the capital of Sana'a following a months-long lull while Houthis shelled government-held areas. The sudden spike in violence across long stalemated front lines threatens to exacerbate the 5-year conflict and complicate indirect peace talks between Saudi Arabia and the Iran-backed rebels. The United Nations revealed on Monday chilling new details about an airstrike that smashed into a migrant detention center in Libya, killing at least 50 individuals. The July attack sparked international condemnation and accusations of war crimes. The 13-page report said the conduct of compound officials at the time of the deadly attack may have contributed to the high death toll, and documented numerous violations of international law by warring Libyan militias, and urged further investigation to ensure accountability. As U.S. President Donald Trump's Senate impeachment trial continues, it's been jolted by new claims that undercut a key defense argument. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has more on today's presentation by the White House.
The president and his lawyer say he did not tie withholding military aid to Ukraine to his demand for investigating Joe Biden. But former Trump National Security Advisor John Bolton alleges in a forthcoming book that's exactly what the president did. As they resumed their case, the president's lawyers did not directly address Bolton's revelations. But Jay Sekulow says there's no proof the president did it.
Not a single witness testified that the president himself said that there was any connection.
Top Senate Democrat Chuck Schumer says they're out there.
We want Bolton. We want Mulvaney.
Upping pressure on Republicans to allow witness testimony. Four GOP senators would have to sign on, and two are now publicly indicating they're on board, Mitt Romney and Susan Collins.
Like war, impeachment is hell.
Former independent counsel Ken Starr's investigation of President Clinton led to the House impeaching Clinton. He's now on President Trump's legal team and says there's nothing more divisive for the nation.
Those of us who lived through the Clinton impeachment understand that.
Starr told the Senate impeachment requires two things, an actual crime and a genuine national consensus.
That the president must go away.
He says neither exists in this case, and after just one presidential impeachment in the nation's first 200 years, Congress is now too quick to act.
We are living in what I think can aptly be described as the age of impeachment.
One Democratic senator calls that absurd and quite rich, coming from Ken Starr. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
Now for analysis of those arguments and more, I earlier spoke with Joel Richard Paul, professor at the University of California Hastings College of the Law.
Well, it affects the defense arguments, I think, in two ways. First, it may be persuasive to many Republicans now that they need to call other witnesses, even if they have no intention of voting to remove the president from office. They may still feel, I think, that if they fail to call those witnesses and if more evidence continues to come out in the press anyway, that they're going to look like they haven't done their job and there may be political consequences for them if they fail to do so. The other way in which it affects the defense, I think, more immediately is this. It appears in the case of John Bolton that he has submitted the manuscript involved to the White House for their review. And I have to believe that Mr. Cipollone knows that he must have seen this manuscript in advance, and he's had it for some weeks. And if he knew what John Bolton said in that text, he could not, in good conscience, stand up and make the argument he has now made before the Senate, which is that Mr. Trump never conditioned the aid. If Mr. Cipollone has made a false statement to the Senate in this trial before the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, he may have some ethical problems, and he actually should probably recuse himself from further involvement in the trial. He's also in the position now where he represents the office of the president, not the president himself. And now there's a conflict between the interests of the office of the presidency and the president if Mr. Bolton's allegations are true.
The president's team concludes its presentation on Tuesday, and then it opens up the floor to questions to both sides. If you were a senator sitting as a member of the jury in this impeachment trial, what kind of questions would you want to ask?
I think what I would want to know about the defense attorneys is what they knew about John Bolton's claim and when they knew it. I would want to know what the truth is that they know that is not being made available to the Senate and the misrepresentations that they may have made to the Senate. But I really think the interesting question from an evidentiary point of view, which I don't think anyone is exploring at this point, is how this whole transaction was financed. Where did the money come from that financed Lev Parnas and Rudy Giuliani and others in all of their travels and all of their engagements? There is this continuing story about large transfers of money between Lev Parnas and Mr. Giuliani. That money must have come from somewhere, and I think we would want to know where it came from, because the implication is that the money may have come from abroad.
And that would be an outside influence on an election, correct?
It would be an outside influence on the election. It could possibly be a violation of campaign finance laws. It also may further fill out the story as to the extent to which this whole narrative that Ukraine and not Russia was responsible for interfering in the 2016 election, it may explain to us whether that narrative really is coming from Russia and whether it's Russia that is behind the allegations against the Bidens as well.
That was Professor Joel Richard Paul from the UC Hastings College of the Law speaking to me from California. And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers have found a number of exoplanets whose orbits are in what is called the habitable zone. A planetary system's habitable or Goldilocks zone is an orbital region around a star where it's not too hot nor too cold, and any orbiting planets could have liquid water on its surface, something that's essential to support life. A new study from Rice University in Houston, Texas, suggests simply residing in a star's habitable zone may not be enough to determine a planet's actual habitability. The planet's star also needs to be on its best behavior. According to the study, a number of Earth-like planets found orbiting in the habitable zone also circle too close to their stars to escape the effects of the star's strong magnetic fields and associated radiation. The study authors are building a computer model to help determine how a star's atmosphere and magnetic fields affect planets in its habitable zone. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. With just over a month to go before Israel's next election, both Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and chief rival Benny Gantz held separate meetings with U.S. President Donald Trump in Washington on Monday. On the table is Trump's so-called deal of the century, which will reportedly give Israel control over large parts of the West Bank. Some in Israel say Mr. Trump is trying to influence the election. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
President Donald Trump has been working on his Israeli-Palestinian peace deal for almost as long as he has been in office. But it is only now, just ahead of Israel's third round of elections on March 2nd, that he is releasing the details of the plan. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the plan is a great opportunity for Israel. The Prime Minister also said he is leaving for Washington with a great sense of responsibility and that he hoped he and President Trump would make history. Netanyahu's rival, Benny Gantz, wrangled a private meeting with Trump, hoping to show that he is a serious contender for Prime Minister. But the focus in Israel has now shifted from corruption allegations against Netanyahu to the political and diplomatic sphere where he excels. Details of the plan have not been released, but Israeli press reports say it gives Israel control over chunks of the West Bank, including the Jordan Valley, which runs along the border between the West Bank and Jordan. Amos Yadlin, former head of military intelligence, says the plan is a dream from Israel's point of view. Yadlin said that this plan offers parameters that are much better for Israel and include complete control over the Jordan Valley, control over the airspace in the West Bank, and a demilitarized Palestinian state. Palestinians who have cut off all ties with the Trump administration have responded angrily to the reported details. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtaya said Trump is interfering in Israel's election. Shtaya said the move is meant to save Trump from impeachment and Netanyahu from going to jail. Some Israeli analysts agree that Trump is trying to get Netanyahu, his friend, to win the election. Mark Zell is the chairman of Republicans Overseas Israel, a political group for Republicans who live outside the United States. Zell tells Israel Radio it could mean that the results of this election will give Israelis what they wanted all along, a partnership between Netanyahu and Gantz.
So I think the president may well be trying to do something that's connected to the peace plan, but somewhat apart from it, and that is to help Israel and the principal protagonists in the battle for the Israeli government, Netanyahu and Gantz, to somehow overcome their difficulties and come together and form a unity government so that we can get on with the business of conducting foreign policy and defense here in the Middle East.
Zell said the prior elections have failed to produce a government and that the deal of the century could change that. Linda Gradstein, Jerusalem.
January 31st is this coming Friday. Not only is it the end of the month, but it's the day that Brexit officially takes place. While the world has been occupied with news of the coronavirus outbreak in China and its spread around the world, or what's been happening in the United States with President Trump's impeachment trial, a major economic and political story has seemingly fallen off many of people's radars. But with Britain's exit imminent, I spoke earlier with London-based reporter Henry Ridgewell to find out how people are preparing for Brexit at week's end.
Well, as you say, there have been so many other things in the news lately, the coronavirus, the impeachment, here in the United Kingdom as well, a lot of focus on the royal family's troubles as well. It's almost as if Brexit Day has come up as a bit of a surprise, and it's at the end of the week. There is a party planned in central London by the backers of Vote Leave, a celebration. They wanted to get the bells of Big Ben chiming, but that's undergoing renovation at the moment, so they can't. So there will be some events to mark Brexit Day. They have minted a new 50 pence coin with the words peace, prosperity and friendship to all nations to mark the moment. But the government itself and Prime Minister Boris Johnson are treading carefully on this because I think they still recognise that the country is divided on this. At least half of the country is not celebrating on the 31st of January. They don't want Brexit to go ahead, and the country remains bitterly divided. So there will be some celebrations, there will be some angst among a lot of Remainers as well. And it remains to be seen what happens on the 1st of February and where the government goes from here.
You mentioned angst by Remainers and possibly some other people who did not want to leave the European Union. But hey, there's 11 months of deal-making time remaining to solidify all of the nuances of the divorce deal. But until then, things largely remain the same. So why are people experiencing angst when, on the surface of things, it doesn't look like much will change on February the 1st?
I think there's two reasons. The first is the direction of travel of the government and of Boris Johnson and the rhetoric that is coming out of No. 10 Downing Street. He, as I have said, is insisting that he's not going to extend that transition period. There is an option to extend it by another 2 years. He has put into law that he will not extend it. And if you look at all past trade deals that the European Union has done, the most recent being with Canada and Japan, they have taken several years to negotiate and several years to ratify. And to cram all of that into the space of a few months, given that probably every single national parliament in the European Union will have to ratify it, you would think that raises the chances again of us going back to all we were talking about in the fall of last year of there being a big cliff edge and all of that uncertainty coming. But Boris Johnson, moreover, has made it very clear that he does not want a close relationship with the European Union going forward. So all those who proposed or were supporters of EU membership and wanted to remain close, I think they know now that Boris Johnson, having won the 80-seat majority in Parliament, their hopes of staying close to the European Union, of retaining those rights to live and work and travel around the continent, are pretty much dashed, and they are going to have to live with whatever this new government negotiates. And I think the second aspect of this is really something to do with identity. And this goes deep down into the divisions in the country, that half of the country really embraced their European identity, or at least enjoyed or appreciated the perceived benefits of European Union membership. The other half see a much better future outside of the European Union, and that really is what it's coming down to now, is a question of identity.
That was reporter Henry Ridgewell speaking to me from London. It was on Monday, 75 years ago, Soviet Union soldiers liberated the Auschwitz death camp in Poland, where over a million people, mostly Jews, were systematically murdered by the Nazis. Ever since, Holocaust survivors, their descendants, and supporters have reminded the world to never forget the horrors of the Holocaust and the evil humans everywhere are capable of. VOA's Adam Phillips has this report on how one Jewish family whose matriarch survived Auschwitz keeps the memory of the Holocaust alive.
Oded Ravek, now 64, was born 10 years after his mother Livia and her two sisters were freed from Auschwitz and began the long trek that eventually led them to the State of Israel. But Ravek says his parents' memories of the Holocaust were a constant underlying presence in their otherwise happy home.
They told us about the hard labor, about the clothing. You know, they were youngsters. My mom was a teenager. And all of a sudden, she found herself in a cattle cart. She couldn't move. And she thought she'll wake up and it will be over. But it was reality. And the German shepherd dogs and the SS shouting and the scene must have looked like insane. And then having them all tattooed and the removal of the humanity and the clothing that they have to take off. My mom explained, you know, to us in detail how ashamed they all were, you know, that the Germans were laughing and kicking and cursing. It was a terrible experience as one could ever have.
Ravek says the experience still haunts his mother at night, even at the age of 93. Still, he has never viewed her as a victim.
I always saw her as a heroine and could never understand how she could smile, how she could raise a family and have good humor and live a long and very fulfilling life with this hanging over her head, knowing that when night comes, it always takes her back to Auschwitz, and then the next morning she's cheerful and happy.
The realities of Auschwitz came to Ravek when he and his wife and children and other relatives traveled with his mom to the camp, which is now a museum. That's when he got the idea to get his own tattoo bearing the number inked into his mother's arm. It was a way to honor her and her fading generation, and to offer a visible reminder of the Holocaust to others.
My mom, may she be well, is just turned 93, and that generation is dwindling, so many deniers out there. I had many people stop me and ask me, what is the number? You would think in this day and age, people would know about the Holocaust, but I explained to them why I have the number. You know, I'm talking to people about the events that happened, not only to my mom, but to a whole lot of Jews from all over Europe.
Ravek's son, Amir, is one of several family members who have followed his father's example. Amir says his tattoo has often given him strength during hard times.
You know, a lot of times, like, life hits you down, whether, like, financially, whether emotionally, and like, sometimes, you know, I really do want to give up, and I don't want to continue. Life's yeah. tough. And so when I think of, like, what my grandma went through, and then what I personally go through, nothing really in life seems that big. No problem seems too tough. You know, you've never seen anything in your life that compares. It really brings me to a place where, like, I'm so grateful to be alive and how lucky I am to exist.
While the world remembers Auschwitz on this day, Oded Ravek says his mother lives it every day. For him, it's a time to wonder if the truth of the Holocaust has prompted humans to be kinder and more tolerant and understanding of each other. Ravek admits to being both slightly optimistic and deeply skeptical. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
While the Grammys were being handed out inside the Staples Centers in Los Angeles, California, Sunday night, fans were paying tribute to Kobe Bryant outside. AP Entertainment correspondent Oscar Wells Gabriel shares some of those fans' thoughts.
As one fan, Renee Sotomayor, put it,
"Today's the day that part of L.A. died."
And indeed, the scene in the plaza near the Staples Center took on the kind of mournful scene reminiscent of what happened when Michael Jackson died in 2009. People lit candles, displayed memorabilia, and talked about the shock. Julie Sierra noted,
"For the amount of people that are out here, it's silent. Everybody's in grief. Everybody's mourning."
Even so, some fans paid tribute to Bryant as though they were still inside the Staples Center watching him play.
Kobe, 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 Kobe.
I'm Oscar Wells Gabriel.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, thank you very much for starting your day with us. You can visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. And you can also find archived copies of the show on the program page under the Live Radio tab. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day. This is the